Now, please welcome to the stage our very own Jason Rantz.
Hello. Thank you guys for coming out. Thank you guys for coming out. I really appreciate it. I kind of jinxed things because I said on the radio earlier today there was not going to be any traffic, which I probably should not have done because there was definitely traffic for me when I got here. Thank you guys for coming out for what I hope is going to be a really engaging conversation across all different angles connected to the crime crisis that we are very clearly going through. I know some folks want to pretend that we are not, except I look at the data and it seems very clear that we are. And I feel like we know why. I feel like in some cases, maybe we don't know why. And so tonight, over the course of the next 2 hours, you're going to hear a lot of different perspectives from people who are experts in what it is they do. You're hearing from Republicans. You're hearing from Democrats. You're hearing from people who, I don't know what I am, and I'm not going to tell you. So we hope that we're going to get to cover a lot of material. We did not announce our first guest. This is a very special guest. Perhaps someone who is going to run for governor at some point. Feel like his name gets brought up a lot. You know him as a former sheriff and a former congressman. Welcome to the stage, Dave Reichert.
Wow, thank you. You may not recognize me with my glasses on. It's like Superman. No. Hey, I got 10 minutes. Jason asked me to talk a little bit about how did we get to the current state that we're in today. And I actually have been thinking about this for a number of years since I left Congress and how we got here. So I normally am a good storyteller and try to keep people on the edge of their seats. But I'm going to whip through this because we have a great number of people behind me in the backstage here that want to get to further discussion. So, all right, you hanging on to your seats? Okay, here we go. I believe that the current state that we are in today didn't just happen overnight. This has been occurring over decades. So what I did is I looked back into my years, and am I making that noise? Into the 70s, 80s, and 90s as to some of the things that have been occurring. So the state of chaos is what I call our current state. Began decades ago. It's been accelerated in recent years. Began in the 70s and 80s. And it has started by slowly eliminating and changing laws that protected and aided children, parents, the mentally ill, the homeless, and addicts, amongst a whole list of other folks that need our help. They eliminated, back in the 70s and the 80s, there was actually a law that was a public nuisance law that you could arrest people for. I think that was, as I look back, one of the laws that began to change kind of how cops did their job. You had to become more inventive, even more so today. Eliminated curfew laws for children, truancy laws for children. I'm not talking about high school kids, but younger kids even. Rights of children, the rights of children are now promoted over parental rights. That began the erosion of our family unit, in my opinion. The rights of homeless are now promoted over our duty and responsibility to care for those who are less fortunate. Eventually, efforts to enforce laws morphed into accusations that the criminal justice system, especially cops, were enforcing the law with inequality. The entire criminal justice system has been accused of, more and more and more as time goes on, of systemic racism. Let me just give you some examples that happened over history. 1999, WTO. Some of you might remember I was the sheriff back during that event. Here's what the mayor told you. Peaceful. All the protesters were going to be peaceful. For the most part, they were. Some were not. There were anarchists in the groups. They directed the Seattle police officers, some of whom you'll meet here in a few minutes, not to make arrests in the beginning. They actually allowed the anarchists back in 1999 to take over one of the buildings in downtown Seattle. And so does that remind you of anything that just recently happened in Seattle? So that's 1999, ladies and gentlemen. So it's just slowly progressing forward. In fact, I happened to be in a car with Ron Sims driving through around Seattle, just to give him an idea of what was going on. A call came across the radio that the Radio Shack on 3rd Avenue was being burglarized. Some of you might remember this. I was in the back seat. I had our detective drive me to that scene, got out of the car, and chased three suspects out of the Radio Shack down 3rd Avenue. They eventually got caught. The point that I want to make about this story is that the mayor accused me of chasing innocent children down the streets of Seattle. These were burglars, and later SPD caught these three people, and they were gang members. So doesn't that remind you of things that are happening today? Even more intensely so, though. In 2002, Deputy Miller, you might not remember this one, Miller was at home, car parked in his driveway, east of Renton, just east of here. He went down to the car, confronted the driver. Driver pulls a gun. Fortunately, Deputy Miller had his gun with him, stepped back, fell away from the truck, and shot three rounds into the truck, and sadly killed the driver of that truck, who was an ex-felon who should not have had the weapon in the first place. But Deputy Miller was called a racist, and I was called Bull Connor in the Seattle Times. Does that sound familiar to you, right? It's just, in my opinion, this has been building. And you know, one of the most significant, I think, events that occurred, not violent, but I think very persuasive in the minds of some, was the day that President Obama accused a police officer who responded to a burglary of racism when he put a person who lived there on his hands and knees. He didn't know who owned the house, and the owner happened to be of African-American descent. In fact, what Obama had to do was invite the police officer to the White House for a beer summit. But for me, his rhetoric around police still continued. And I think there were people then were starting to believe the president. I know some might disagree with this, but I think that beer summit and the fact that he accused this officer in the first place of being a racist was one of the things that really started to divide America even further. It was significant. Mistrust and disrespect for law enforcement was increased, I think, further divided America, and further claims of police abuse. But I want to note real quickly that between then and now, I think you'll all agree, there were some events that took place where police officers, police chiefs, and sheriffs saw they had failed. There's been some real tragic events as far as shootings and wrestling suspects to the ground, knees on necks for 10 minutes or more. You ask any professional police officer, that's extreme and uncalled for. So law enforcement recognized those, but it didn't help, right? It even fueled the fire more, as you might have noticed, watching the news and seeing those events played out over and over and over. But law enforcement today is taking responsibility for that. They've improved training. They've improved hiring. And you'll hear more about that as the panels come together. But the rhetoric around police bias and abuse increased. I say extreme left politicians, radical groups, and liberal media have seized this opportunity. And the elected officials now have imposed their views on America. And here's how they do it. They refusing to keep their oath to protect and defend our Constitution. They've raised their right hand. I did it three times in the Air Force, the Sheriff's Office, and in Congress. I took that oath seriously. The people that we elect today are not doing that. They've lied to us as far as I'm concerned. Even more egregious, they refuse to recognize that these rights are not given to us by the government. These are rights that are given to us by our Creator. Thank you. So they lied when they took the oath. They twisted the truth to fit their narrative. Right is wrong. Wrong is right. Up is down. Down is up. We're living in a very chaotic, upside-down world. They repeat their lies until it becomes accepted as fact. They reject and discard the truth. And this has become an all-consuming effort to gain and hold power. That's what this is all about. They have descended into a state of where they have no conscience. They paint crime now, all crime, with the brush of legality. Cops are bad guys. Crooks are victims. And victims are liars. What happened? There's a tremendous, now because of all of this, the results are the tremendous lack of support for our law enforcement. You'll hear from Seattle cops back here that they're down, I think, almost maybe 300 or more police officers. The King County Sheriff's Office, where I used to work, are down at least a couple hundred, the last I heard. There are laws now that are passed that defund the police, laws releasing criminals. I've been fighting a case for 5 years to keep a guy in jail that tried to kill five people at the Barn Door Tavern in 1980. He killed three. Two survived, two women, stripped naked, hung from a bathroom stall by a cord. Their ligature broke. They crawled, found a phone, called us, and we came to the scene. We caught the two guys. But they've been trying to let, Timothy Pauley is his name, they've been trying to let him out of prison for the last 5 years. I've been to parole board hearings and on Zoom and in person with the victims and their families. It's a sad case. He's still in prison, by the way. We've been successful up to this point. They reduce sentences. There are no bail laws across the country, lowering the threshold for charging. When I left as the sheriff, one of the changes in the prosecutor's office and in the juvenile justice system was that a youth would not be charged with auto theft until they committed seven auto thefts. Then they could be charged, arrested, and charged. I don't know what the rule is today. I don't know if it's changed. But that's going back to when I was the sheriff, and I left in 2005. So they're refusing to enforce some laws. They are limiting pursuits of criminals. Blatant lawlessness is ignored. Remember the broken windows theory, misdemeanors matter? That's totally broken windows, thrown out the window, not used anymore. So, bottom line, no support, less cops. No cops, who protects us? What happens? There's no trust in the government anymore that they're going to protect us, so what do? We buy guns and we're going to protect ourselves, right? Well, that's not... Sadly, that's not the society we want to live in. We want government officials, when they raise their right hand, to mean what they say when they're going to protect our rights and protect our families. So all this does is further the chaotic state that we're in. And I went through my list. I'm almost done back there, Jason, if you're wondering. I don't even know if 10 minutes is up. Man, I could tell some funny stories, too. But okay, so I'm always looking for solutions, right? I've got so many ideas on how to solve these problems, but I don't have the time tonight to go into all this. So I want to give you one thought as far as the solutions go. Can we start to elect people that have integrity? Who believe the truth, who believe that people are innocent until proven guilty. All right. Here's what cops did when I was the sheriff, real quick. A sheriff deputy takes a homeless family to a local restaurant, buys dinner. A sheriff's deputy gets called to a house, finds out that the boy has just shoplifted a candy bar, finds out they have no money for food. She goes to the grocery store and buys $200 worth of food, brings it back to the family. An elderly couple runs out of gas, calls the sheriff's office. They got a ride home from somebody. They can't remember where they left their car. The sheriff's office on Saturday, it wasn't me. The sheriff's office, I could have gone somewhere else with that, but I don't think I will. The sheriff's office on Saturday, an off-duty employee decides to drive up and down I-5, finally locates the car, calls the elderly couple, and they get their son to come and pick up the car. They filled it with gas and brought it to the police station. I want to tell you these stories because that's what cops are doing today. And those are the things. Those are the things that we don't hear a whole lot about. Now, we need to do this together, all of us in this room. And I know people say, well, what can we do? What can we do? First of all, elect those officials that I talked about. But this is a speech I gave to my sheriff's office years ago, and I found this thing in a dusty corner of my office at home. Remember, we walk securely because we walk with integrity. All of us in this room need to walk with integrity. People recognize that within all of us when we display that sort of character. We are leaders because of who we are. It's not just something we do. We are servants. Our purpose is determined by the needs of others. Wouldn't that be nice? We are a team, not just a group of people, but people with varied gifts and talents and loyal and responsible, constantly striving to do the impossible. And it may seem impossible today to make a difference. It may seem impossible today that we can't move forward from where we are, but it is not impossible. United we stand, divided we fall, and whatever happened to in God, thank you, guys. Good night.
Are you good, sir? Would you mind putting away your crack pipe?
Great, done.
Look at, listen to this. The homeless agency in Seattle wants nearly $12 billion to help solve that problem. But they just offered employees unlimited vacations on the taxpayer's dime. I don't get it.
Less than half of people removed from homeless camps accepted the offer for shelter last year.
For the 2023 point in time count, Pierce County saw an increase in the number of people experiencing homelessness, with 2,148 people on the street, in their car, or a shelter.
Please welcome to the stage We Heart Seattle founder, Andrea Suarez. Tacoma Police Union President, Henry Betts. The City of Kent Mayor, Dana Ralph. And your moderator and morning show host, Brian Suits.
Mic check. All right, before we, thanks everyone for coming out, by the way. and before we start, I thought I'd have Ms. Suarez, Mr. Betts, and
Mayor Ralph.
And the mayor, Your Honor, introduce themselves.
Hi, thanks for having me. My name is Andrea Suarez. I founded We Heart Seattle, a 28-month-old grassroots coalition. We've picked up almost 1 million pounds of trash and helped over 175 people off the streets with private funded donations and at the hands and feet of volunteers in the city of Seattle.
Yeah, hi. Middle-aged white guy, balding, so yes, I'm a cop.
Oink.
Saw that coming, right? My name's Henry Betts. I'm actually going to give you a different perspective. We have a lot of chiefs, sheriffs, a lot of big leadership in the room tonight. I'm more of a worker. I'm a detective there. I've been 20 years in the city of Tacoma, but I'm also the union president, and I represent the officers, detectives, and sergeants that work for Tacoma PD. Give kind of the working perspective. Thank you.
All right, Dana Ralph, mayor for the amazing city of Kent. Thank you. On a mission to explain to people why Kent's a great place, and going to take care of my city any way I can.
And thank all of you for coming. For the purposes of this audience and me, I think it's important to point out there's the homeless industrial complex, and then there's people that do it without tax dollars, and that's Ms. Suarez and her foundation. So that's why she's up wearing a yellow vest that says ambassador or something. I was recently asked by a BBC podcast that they're concentrating on the West Coast of the USA, and they know that I spent 15-plus years in L.A. and purposely came back to, you know, what you all think is a mess, but... And they asked me to describe it, and I said, well, if you don't mind, I'm going to use a baseball analogy. And on the West Coast of the USA, common sense comes to bat after everyone else has struck out. You know, in this case, you know, on third base is let's try to just, you know, be nice. At here on second base is somebody do something. And at first place in government, you know, so it's foundation, law enforcement, and in elected office, they're at first base, it's this crap ain't working. And then common sense comes to bat. So that's my approach. We're talking about the crime. You know, we're going to get out of why they're in the tent, why they're homeless or RV-less or whatever. But once they're there, why does every municipality on the West Coast, except like San Diego, why does the crime rate go up? What are they doing different? What is it about the homeless population and then within 10 blocks of them, the crime rate? In the case of Officer Betts or Detective Betts, if you know Tacoma and you know Bass Pro Shop, you know that whole neighborhood. Don't go there. So if you don't go there, you don't go to Bass Pro Shop. And Bass Pro Shop is armed security. You know, so many people are walking in there and getting stuff and the whole thing. So we're going to focus on, okay, you're in the tent. Why does that make you commit crimes? So Andrea, in your case, you're dealing retail and with them in between committing crime or whatever. Can you tell who is going to sleep in because they stole a bunch of mountain bikes? And you know, can you tell the difference?
Absolutely. I didn't set out to become a subject matter expert. We were birthed out of frustration why there were needles everywhere and trash in our parks and green spaces. And we just started picking up the trash and found a lot of truth in doing that and built trust and, frankly, mutual respect with people living outside rough committing crimes. And the number one reason they're committing crimes is to fuel their addiction. And, you know, sometimes I wonder, are they the criminal or is it their perpetrator, their kingpin, their pimp? And we don't talk enough about the upstream crime that puts that person where they're at, that's preying on that vulnerable person in the throes of their addiction.
So in the continuum of they're all criminals, which is what I say, and oh no, they're there because their bank laid them off and they were successful investment bankers and it's not their fault, they need a roof and not a tent. Mm-hmm. What would you divide it into a percentage of who you think is there because they just like to get high and steal my mountain bike?
Well, nobody has ID. Everybody's running from warrants. They're running from child support debt. They're running from a lot of baby mamas. I come from a family that was broken, and my biological father worked a cash job his whole entire life, so he never had to pay my mom any form of child support debt. And all of this started to click. Like, why is everybody on the run, off-grid, doesn't have ID, it's always stolen? All of our low-barrier shelters don't require you to have ID. You could be Mickey Mouse one day, Peter Pan the next. And I started poking around and really realizing there's no accountability whatsoever in this industry. And people are committing crimes because they're allowed to feed their addiction. until you've held a grown man in your arms who's weeping with a $150 wad of dope to feed their addiction for the day that says, Andrea, I can't get arrested for my warrants. And no other social service provider is calling to get him into detox or any form of rehabilitation because we're supposed to meet them where they're at, and maybe this is their form of success. I mean, we're breaking down all of that that current narrative and encountering it and disrupting it through boots on the ground volunteering.
And so, Detective Henry, here's the deal. Not all crime is drug crime, but there's been an increase in crime in general. And in Tacoma, we saw this outbreak of teenage, you know, vape store robbers. And there was a guy with the 19-year-old with a prosthetic leg who stood out on the video. In your experience, with the guys that you run down for the murders and all that, are there any clean, non-addicted people that just want to steal stuff like the old days?
Yeah, I imagine there's some 10-year-olds taking Snickers bars or something, but that's not what we're focused on, right? I mean, when we talk about, it's so crazy when you look at it. Historically speaking, a union president, all I would worry about is how to help my people, right? How do I help the cops? In the last 2 or 3 years, due to what the community's feeling, I don't even speak about the cops anymore. I don't. What we deal with is the cops show up 4 or 5 hours late in Tacoma because there's so many pending calls, and they're frustrated beyond their means, and we're so sick of being yelled at by the community for being late, not being there, not solving the problem because we can't book people, we're not taking them to jail. All these problems have just culminated that we're not seeing that theft that you're talking about. We're seeing the constant problem and the frustration of the community. So now, at any one of these things where I speak, it's not even about the cops. It's all about regurgitating the frustrations that the community has when they've been handed their 13th case card for the victimization that they just keep seeing. There's a lot to that now.
Yeah. And can, Detective Betts doesn't speak officially for the Tacoma PD, I imagine, right? So can I ask you about recruiting and retention? Because this is a problem region-wide. We're hemorrhaging experienced police officers to Boise, to Laramie, to Madras, Oregon. They're fleeing these areas of the west coast of Washington and going to places where apparently they think they can enforce the law. Is that how you're losing guys?
Yeah. Yeah, we've lost them
out
of state.
When I say guys, you mean men and women and all that.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely, it's horrible. Staffing is down almost in almost every agency. I was really happy to get to meet the mayor next to me because I talk really well about Kent. If you don't know, Kent is a fully staffed police department now. And that is an exception. It is not the rule. You'll hear, and you ask yourself, why is that, right? Is it just about money? Do they go there just to get paid? And it's not. Seattle pays their officers really well. Tacoma's doing okay, but we can't keep cops. And why is that? And I think the biggest missing piece is, do you support your cops? And when leadership, and by leadership, I mean chiefs and sheriffs, I mean mayors, I mean councils, if you don't support your police, they're not going to stay there. And they don't, and you see it. And I've tuned into Kent City Council meetings, which puts a lot of people to sleep. Sorry, that's council meetings
not
for
the
you.
Most exciting.
But I've tuned into Kent once just to watch cops get spoken highly of. They get awarded at council meetings. They get, they're loved in Kent, and now they're fully staffed. And there's a connection there that I think a lot of other cities are missing.
And for morale in your department, how is the community? So now that they see how bad it can be, or they think they're seeing how bad it can be, are the Tacoma police
I'll give you my best analogy for this. If you think back going into a Denny's, sometimes you get a good waitress, sometimes you get a bad waitress. If that waitress was having a horrible day and she had a horrible manager and she hated her job, what are the chances she's having a good day when she brings you coffee, right? Now imagine being a cop who, sees a bunch of political prosecution of cops, who sees, political leaders and leadership in their own chain throwing you under the bus or not caring about you. Carry that around for a while, and you just think, what are your chances of having your best day at your job? Imagine going call to call to call, and you're 4 hours late, and you didn't sign up not to do your job. So the chances that you're going to provide the level of service that everybody's paying the taxes for, it's not good.
So Mayor Dana, what percentage of your day-to-day job has to do with dealing with crime in Kent? And did you poach police officers from other, from crappy police departments?
A significant amount of my day is dealing with my constituents that have been victims of crime, working with my officers on how we're combating that because of all of the things that that the detective has just said. And the reality is, yes, we did a good job with laterals, bringing them into the Kent Police Department.
And, I'm assuming no Kent resident complained about a fully staffed police department, right?
And so here's the struggle, though, and I think this is the second half of that conversation. We are fully staffed to the number of officers we have budget for, which is very different than being a fully staffed police department. Data shows that Washington State is 51st in staffing per capita for police. 51st. Let that sink in. Like, we are at the very, very bottom for officers per 1,000 residents.
Mayor, if I may, just to put that in context, you've heard of New York City, small city on the East Coast. They have one cop for every 235 people in New York City. In Tacoma, we have one per every 600 residents. So just think about that.
Yeah. We're at like 1.2 for every 1,000 residents. So yes, we're fully staffed to budget. We're not fully staffed to what we need to do to serve our community. So we have the exact same issues. When we have an incident, my officers have to determine, is this violent assault that's happening the most important thing that I have to do, or is it the robbery down the street, or is it, you know, what we saw last weekend with the 200 cars taking over an intersection? And that juggling act, that running from call to call to call, is exhausting.
And these days, you can't do an intersection takeover without some shots fired.
So they, well, apparently not anymore.
Yeah. And so, Detective Betts, I would defer to you on this. In your experience, training and experience, is it true that 2/3 or 3/4 of the crimes are done by 10% of the population, or let's say 1/4 of the criminals?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there was a really
frequent
good study.
Flyers, right?
Yes. Yep. And there was a guy who did an independent study out of Seattle not too long ago that looked at their number one offenders and how many, there was a small number of people that were just in and out of the system constantly. You sprinkle in some COVID like that. I keep waiting for a politician or somebody to say it's 2 weeks, 2 weeks to flatten the crime curve, right? It's going to come down, guys. Hang in there. We're working on it. But it is. It's a small number of people who repeatedly do these crimes. And I'll tell you what, if you're living with that, like in Tacoma a couple of years ago, maybe 18 months ago, we had somebody who lived on a block where they were repeatedly criminalized by the same homeless encampment. And eventually that resulted in a homicide because the neighbors were so upset that they ended up having conflicts with these people on their own, took it into their own hands. That's not the right answer. Law enforcement should solve that problem, but we can't. If we're 4 hours late and they're already gone and they come back later, we hate that that's happening more and more, but that is where we're at.
And there's that new RV encampment right there in Tacoma, right off I-5. And every neighbor that I can name names, but I won't. But my colleagues in local TV in Seattle and Tacoma had to edit out. They had to go looking actively for someone who said, "I'm just glad they have a safe place to be." Everyone else said, "The crime rate went right through my roof." And these are hardworking people. This is not a wealthy neighborhood. Is there a correlation in Kent between, is there a homeless camp encampment in Kent?
We do. I think the difference about Kent that sets Kent apart from a lot of other bigger cities is I've got officers that are actively, only two of them, but they're actively going around and they're addressing those camps as they pop up. So we don't let them establish. Because we know that it creates a problem.
I know that, like, in my case, the most dangerous part of my day, I live in a certain bucolic little South Sound town just inside Thurston County, and we yelming love it. But I work on East Lake Avenue East at South Lake Union. And I can leave my car unlocked, you know, wide open, where I live, because all my neighbors are veterans and probably used to wear Green Berets and all that, maybe, some say. But East Lake, I witness people, metastasizing off Capitol Hill with someone else's mountain bike. And the rhythm of this is they steal your stuff and my stuff, and they taken to a windowless van that's driving around Capitol Hill, and the guy will just give him $100 for your $3,000, you know, Cannondale mountain bike. Because all he needs right then is $100. And there's a weird rhythm to that. And it's like from when I get to work at 4 a.m. to when I leave at 9. So are you seeing similar patterns like that in, I mean, what is crime o'clock in Tacoma? I don't go to work through Parkland anymore or Lakewood because that's like all the murders happen from 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. So I don't drive to work through there.
It starts shortly after midnight, ends about 11 p.m.
Yeah. So
yeah. I mean, it's Tacoma. Like, no, but I think we do see a huge spike in crime related to the homelessness, and I think the frustration there is that we can respond to the camps, we can go out and we can do things, but the cops can't solve it because we really took away our ability just to book people in. And I think the bigger part of the conversation is you look at that, and what blows me away is you see people experiencing mental health or drug use that gets them into mental health, and now we don't do anything with them. We're not going to grab them and go take them someplace against their will. And so now we've decided that compassion is just leaving them there. And it's not. Nobody believes that. Nobody believes that that's compassion to leave them there.
No. And so, Andrea, when you're dealing, I mean, what time of day is most effective for you? And do you, is there a time or a profile of a person who comes forward and says, I'm done with this crap. My tent's full of mountain bikes. You know, I want to go into housing.
Well, our approach is intervention forward rather than harm reduction forward. Intervention is harm reduction, and we lead the way in our private, you know, breaking current policy with a, you know, hey, how can we give you a hand up and out of this hot mess rather than, you know, meeting you where you're at and giving you more peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I think it comes down to a model and approach because we pick up the trash and level set the power dynamic. Getting dirty, picking up the trash, it's a level of respect and love that the homeless have not felt, whether they're in the throes of their addiction or untreated mental health or, you know, committing crimes all day. I mean, so many homeless are like, I'm so sick and tired of being coddled. I'm so sick and tired of being, you know, a criminal. I'm so sick and tired of selling my body and turning tricks for fentanyl. And I'm not talking about women. I'm talking about straight men who are selling themselves to perverts on the street, who are waving money out the windows of their car down Third Avenue, preying on vulnerable boys and youth wearing a hoodie and a skateboard. I've seen it. I have videos of it. These are my clients. And so I think it's about an approach, and it's 24/7 and, you know, about these, like, areas to avoid. Don't go down Third. Don't go down this intersection. Don't go down that intersection. I would encourage you to go very much down that intersection. The reason why it's that way in the first place is because we've, as a society, have avoided it. I think we have to lean in and activate those hot spots and go into our parks and clean up the trash. You know, prior mentioned was the broken window theory. I say it's the We Heart theory, and we have to start caring and volunteering and lending a helping hand. Each and every one of us can be an outreach worker.
And it's funny because here on the West Coast, there's a couple communities, and I always, say, folks, it's got to hit bottom, and it's got to be rebuilt. It has to shatter. You know, some of the elected officials in King County and the state, they don't see the problem. The problem is how much more tax money can they pull out of you and repurpose it to hire their niece, you know, or whatever. That's their goal. I mean, they actually have a vested interest in some of these people remaining in addiction. And I met, where we lived in L.A., in the high desert of L.A., I met people that were homeless and they just were out camping. You know, they stayed there with their pit bulls. And, you know, they talked to you at the feed store and they're like, nope, I live, you know, 8 miles up the hill there. They were not committing crimes. But that's why they lived out there, because they couldn't live where services were, because those were all criminals. So there is a way out. Phoenix is doing it right now. There is a way out. And like I always say on my show, it could be worse. We could be Oregon. So, if you haven't been down there, so big round of applause for Andrea Suarez and Detective Betts and Mayor Ralph of Kent. So, thank you all very much. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There is no hiding Seattle's drug problem.
Everybody is just giving in to their demons.
It is here to see in the open every day.
Today, King County recorded its 400th overdose death of the year. The data is shockingly bad.
There were more than 1,000 drug-related deaths last year. Half of those were from synthetic drugs like meth and fentanyl. According to the data, at least 2 people died every day in King County from a fentanyl overdose.
We're going to just de facto legalize drugs in Washington state, which is the worst possible idea I can think of.
Please welcome to the stage City of Bellevue Deputy Mayor Jared Neuenhaus. Seattle Police Officers Guild President Mike Solon. Republican State Representative Dan Griffey. And your moderator, host of Undivided, Brandy Cruz.
Hi, everyone. Gentlemen, can we drop the formalities and can I just do Dan, Mike, Jared?
Absolutely.
Jared's like, no, call me Deputy Mayor every time. I wish I could see you guys. The lights are so blinding, but... it was really nice to see people. I had to cancel my show today because I was physically exhausted, and people were like, I'll see you tonight. And I just wanted to say that I think it's awesome that you guys came out in person on a beautiful Wednesday, Wednesday evening, because it gives me so much hope that you're here because you care. You're here probably because you're concerned. And our friend, you know, Dory Monson, when he passed away, one of the things that I said is, you know, he trained people to be their own best watchdog. And more than ever, there's so few people. Jason does a good job of it, but there's so few watchdogs in media. And so the public, you guys have to step up and fill that role and be your own best watchdog. So being here tonight is a great start. So we're talking about drugs. I don't know if you guys knew this, but we got a little crisis on our hands. So I want to start with how you're seeing the drug epidemic manifest in other ways, because obviously crime is a topic, homelessness is a topic. Jared, I want to start with you because Bellevue's interesting. I feel relatively safe in Bellevue, but to what extent are you guys seeing the drug crisis seep into that city, and how is it impacting it?
Well, first, you are safe in Bellevue, not relevantly. No, so we're not immune to it. But having said that, we're a little bit hamstrung by some of the bills that come through the legislature. And, you know, the Blake bill, for example, really makes it challenging for our officers when we see possession, when we see open public drug use, and we have to refer them twice to treatment before we can actually arrest them. So this causes some challenges. However, we have a reputation in the city of Bellevue that we are constantly making arrests. If we cannot arrest you, you know, usually if they're doing drugs, there's probably something else going on too. So there have been times when, you know, we can find something else to enforce the law, and the drugs just happen to be part of that. But we take a very hard stand on it as much as we possibly can within the law. But we do not want drugs in the city of Bellevue whatsoever. And thank you. And we want, but every city says that. But it's you know, it starts off with a tremendous police department first off, and we support our police department, our brave men and women of our department, constantly give them the tools to make sure that they can enforce the law, even as challenging as it is at times, to ensure that Bellevue does not come a place where drug users or drug sellers really want to come.
Yeah, I love that we've gotten to the point where people applaud when you say we're going to arrest criminals. It's like, we have to celebrate that because it's so freaking rare, yeah. Right? But because you brought up Blake, I'm sure since you guys are in this room on a Wednesday evening, you're familiar for the most part with what happened with the Blake decision. So in 2021, the state Supreme Court struck down our felony drug possession statute, said it was unconstitutional. all lawmakers had to do is just add one word to the law to make it constitutional, but no, they saw it as an opportunity to maybe get toward decriminalization. So there was a special session to try to get a permanent Blake fix before there was de facto legalization on July 1st. Can you just go through, it was a very dramatic finish to the legislative session, but what that bill will do and how it might help with the current situation?
Well, thank you for the question. The Blake 2.0 fix, the one that we did in special session, would recriminalize hard drugs again. It would be a modified gross misdemeanor. We could not come to a conclusion on full misdemeanor. A gross misdemeanor would be up to 364 days in a county detention facility. It is heavily dependent, the success or failure of this piece of legislation, on funding, building, and staffing treatment facilities. I am really concerned that it's too heavily dependent on that. I don't know that we're going to be able to help enough people. So that's why I like the fact that there is some criminal sanctions. Before, the first bill that we failed on the House floor that I voted no on would have said that if you entered into a deferral prosecution, deferred prosecution with your court system, and you checked yourself out of the treatment facility, there was no sanctions. Now, you got to go back to the court and answer to the court for why you checked yourself out. A little bit more accountability. Still a lot of work to do, though.
Yeah. Mike, I've been out with your officers. It's been a while, but downtown Seattle. And, you know, I've had times where they'll see somebody using it, sort of like, well, can't, the Pete Holmes days when he was the city attorney, like, Pete won't charge that. How frustrating has it been for the officers of the Seattle Police Department, and I know the chief is going to speak to, and maybe he'll speak to this, to see the suffering and on the streets and really be hamstrung in what they can do to try to help those individuals?
Yeah, I think as a cop, you're a human being, and the reason why you wanted to be a police officer was to help people in need and also catch bad guys, bad girls from doing bad stuff. And when you walk around downtown in particular, whether you're in uniform or you're out of uniform, and I see it, I'm downtown almost every day, it's a gut punch. Not to sound hyperbolic, but your ability to be an effective police officer is being removed due to activism, which I always call unreasonable activism, and you're watching humans decay in front of you, and there's nothing you can do about it. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, we've lost close to 600 officers in 3 years. And it's only getting worse. And, you know, I try to be an optimist to say, hey, there's brighter times ahead, because I have to lead the remaining cops and sergeants that are still working the street. And I can tell you that morale is the worst I've ever seen it, and I've been a cop almost, next month will make 24 years. Thank you. And I don't, as sad as it is, I don't think it's gotten to the level where people have had enough. And, right? I mean, it's unbelievable. So thanks for the question.
It's kind of terrifying to think what that bottom might look like. But just as a follow-up to that, because you mentioned the staffing issue, I guess even if the legislature did say, oh, let's make it a felony and put these people in prison, which I don't think anybody wants. You just want people to get better. But even if they had the tool and the political will in Seattle to say, yes, let's make these arrests, do they even have the resources to be able to focus on crimes like that, as opposed to responding to 911 and violent crime?
Yeah, good question. No, we don't. You know, we recently did a poll to the Seattle voter, and out of five results, one being the biggest priority, five being the least, one was homelessness, then came the drug issue, fentanyl in particular, crime, and then a few other issues. You know, today I spoke with a sergeant in the SWAT team. And Seattle has a full-time SWAT team. They're very professional. and they partnered with the federal task force, and they actually did a warrant service on an armed fentanyl dealer in the north area of the city. And the community wasn't too particularly fond of seeing what they would deem militarized police go arrest an armed fentanyl dealer. But I don't think we're doing an effective job informing the public as to the reality of what we're dealing with. And we're allowing the activists to continue a false narrative that impacts us all. And I think it's had a detrimental impact that I don't see light at the end of the tunnel for the foreseeable future. But the only option we have is just to keep grinding. That's it.
And feel free to jump in if you want to.
Yeah, I was going to just say, I mean, the resource piece is so critical to this. Just as an example, we had a young kid, I mean, he was 26, died of a fentanyl overdose. Because the Bellevue Police Department is fully staffed, we were able to launch a year and a half investigation. We were able to track back exactly to who sold the fentanyl pills to this young gentleman who ended up passing away from an overdose. Now, that took a year and a half and a lot of time and resources, but we did catch up to him, and now he's being prosecuted for that, for homicide.
You know what you said is that Bellevue PD is fully staffed. They took a lot of the Seattle cops. So I'm looking at this guy. I'm like, wait a minute. Yeah.
I like the conversation about, you know, drug dealers, because when I look at a fentanyl dealer, and there was some bus with, like, you know, 100,000 pills or enough doses to kill every person in King County, I look at a serial killer. I mean, that's how I look at them, right? Because every pill they sell has the potential to kill someone. So Representative Griffey, at the state level, if there's political will from your colleagues on the other side of the aisle, what more can be done to treat them as such, to harden the penalties and dissuade some of those drugs from coming here, because the penalties are so high if they get caught?
Well, I mean, just like you said, there are certain crimes where you just throw away the key, right? You just don't get out and re-injure society. So we need to look at that. We need to look at if you are distributing this drug, this harmful drug, and, you know, they're making it into fancy Skittle shapes and trying to addict children. We should make sure that they're isolated from society. Society has a right to do that. But we need to go after the tools that they use. We worked on a landmark bill this year to make it illegal to own the pill presses that clone the pills into the shapes of FDA-approved drugs with all the markings and all that on there. So we need the political will to really go after them and hold them very accountable. And if that means they have to stay the rest of their life in prison, then so be it.
And the pill press bill passed? The pill press bill passed?
It did.
And
it,
bipartisan, right?
It was. I was number two on the bill, but taking a lot of credit for it, too.
Yeah, it's creative, yes. Take a lot of credit. Do you want to give a shout-out to the Democrat who was on the bill?
Yeah, Mari Leavitt, wonderful lady, and she gets it on fentanyl.
Gotcha. You see, we're just kumbaya here. We get along so well. Jared, you know, Bellevue's interesting because crime doesn't stop at the border of a city. Luckily, you guys have a lake between. It's a little harder, you know. And there's always traffic on the floating bridges, so it's a little harder to get over there. But how do you, and I think you've been successful so far, with a few exceptions, stop what's happening in Seattle from oozing over into your city?
Well, I think there's a lot of different reasons for that. I mean, first and foremost, I think we have a council that is very focused on what's best for the city. We don't tend to get distracted on issues that we have no control over, in terms of what's going on in the Middle East or other things of that nature. We are focused on, number one, public safety. We're focused on transportation, congestion issues. We're focused on keeping Bellevue a very family-friendly city. It's a safe place where people want to work and play and shop. And we really understand that, and that's why so many companies want to come to Bellevue. It's why people want to raise their kids in Bellevue. You do not see very rarely homeless encampments in Bellevue, and if we do see it, it is usually cleared within 24 to 48 hours. Now, we're able to do that because we do have facilities. Due to Martin v. Boise, we have to provide an opportunity to provide them with shelter or services. But we enforce our laws, and that's why I want to pick up on what you said about political will. We have the political will to enforce our laws. Unfortunately, not every city can say the same. But we're willing to do that, and because of that, we've been able to keep some of the craziness, if you will, on the other side of the lake, and we're very proud of that and want to maintain that because, I mean, I'm biased, of course, but I think we've created something special in Bellevue, and we want to keep it that way.
Yeah. Mike, when it comes to officers on the street, you know, the current council has been a little bit of a mess. Is that fair? But this year, there's 7 of 9 seats that will be on the ballot in November. Is it 4 incumbents not running again, or is it 5?
5.
5 incumbents not running again. So there's really an... Okay. Including 2 that have been the most detrimental, I think, to eroding the rule of law and public safety, Lisa Herbold, who somehow ended up chair of the Public Safety Committee, and Shama Sawan. So for you... I will say for the record, I really like Shama Sawant as a person. Her policies are obviously problematic, but I've always enjoyed our chats about our dogs. We found that one thing to connect on. But what is the what opportunity do you think is here this year for the city of Seattle when it comes to these issues like how we deal with substance abuse? Like, what would your message be to voters, I guess, about what's at stake?
If you want more of the same, don't vote.
Oh.
I mean, cause that's the reality. The true point is that 25% on average of the Seattle populace votes. And more often than not, the type of personality that gravitates to a city council seat, I think, are people that don't really are a true reflection of the populace. And that's a problem. And we're seeing, I think you said, you have a council that doesn't go into areas outside the scope of what they're supposed to do. But we tend to have people that want to do that. And obviously you see the results. 2020, we've seen the decline, I think, from 2016 in terms of policing being politicized to an unreasonable level in the city of Seattle, where it was put on steroids. And there's an opportunity here to take back moderate, reasonable positions in politics with public safety. And I just, you know, we're doing what we can, but obviously, you know, we're being respectful of not having a tag of police behind a political candidate because it could be problematic in the city. We're respectful of that. But there's a significant opportunity to take back what has been intentionally lost, impacting not only the people that live in the city, the people that live it, but obviously people in Olympia that are trying to right the wrongs, and then obviously Bellevue using water to block it all. And stealing our cops.
You want to add something quick?
Well, I just wanted to share a quick story. And, you know, when people ask me about, you know, Jared, what's the difference between Seattle and Bellevue? I usually tell them this story about what a Bellevue officer told me when he was called down to Bellevue Square, where a lot of people shop, and they had caught someone who was shoplifting. So put him in the cruiser, taking him back. And so the officer asks, so why did you decide to come to Bellevue today and steal? He's like, well, you know, looking for greener pastures, I thought it'd be easier over here. It seemed like maybe there was a real opportunity here. And he goes, huh, that's interesting. But then the suspect goes, but I got to tell you, officer, I'm shocked right now. And the officer, well, why are you shocked? You were shoplifting, we caught you, and now we're going to, you know, charge you. He's like, yeah, but if I was in Seattle, I'd already be back on the street, and I'd be home by now.
That's true. So we have 1 minute left. And what I want to make sure to do, as much as we're talking about law and order, and I think we all value that as a society, you know, I think Ann Davison, the city attorney in Seattle, said, our laws are our values, which has always stuck with me. And if you're not enforcing your laws, then you're not abiding by your values. But I also want to make sure to note that, you know, these are people who are truly suffering. I mean, people who are willing to take this new drug called Trank that will rot away their flesh. I mean, I think it's hard for a lot of us to put ourselves in the mindset of that level of despair that you're willing to live in. So it's important to keep that kind of empathy front and center when we talk about how do we get these people to be contributing members of society again? Because that's what we all want, right? We want them to get better. So really quickly, like 15 seconds each, we'll start with you, Representative Griffey. What is the appropriate balance between compassion and accountability?
Well, I think it's important. Where I come from, we take the keys away from people that are impaired, and then we drive. We don't let them drive. Right now, the Washington State has turned into a place where we step over people in need. We need to provide resources and change the narrative. We need to be able to call 911. Resources need to be delivered. We've got to give our 911 responders, which I was one for 34 years. We need to give them the resources so they can help people. He's right. All they want to do is help people.
Jared, we'll go to you and give Mike the last word.
Well, the bigger issue is here amongst all these agencies and nonprofits is they use this harm reduction model. And within that harm reduction model, there is very little accountability. Until we can change that, we're not going to see a big change. Because if we are enabling these... And my heart goes out to them, these folks that are so addicted. If we can continue to provide them with the supplies, with the pipes, the needles, whatever, things are not going to change. We need to have accountability. We need to have a hammer, and that usually includes, you know, or requires some type of legal remedy before they are forced to make a change. Are you going to get, you know, addiction help? Are you going to get some services that you clearly need, or do you want to continue to go down this path, which will probably have you dead within a year?
Mike, final word on that, balance between compassion and accountability.
Yeah, everything is about empathy and showing. The fact that you're all here for this panel shows that you care. And we have to embrace that and wrestle back control from the activist groups that are unreasonable, and we become the reasonable activists. It's okay. Activist is not an ugly word. You just have to be reasonable about it. And when you have your city council meetings, get involved, show up for public comment, vote, start your own community groups, take back control. Because if we don't, it's going to be gone.
Yeah. It's a good place to end. Bellevue Deputy Mayor Jared Neuenhaus, Mike Solon, President of the Seattle Police Officer Guild, Representative Dan Griffey, Republican, representing the Allen area. Thank you for being here, and thank you for putting yourselves in a position to try to make a difference. So big round of applause for our panel.
Thank you.
Please welcome to the stage City of Everett Mayor Cassie Franklin.
Good evening. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here tonight and join all of you and talk about something I'm pretty passionate about, which is public safety. So I thought I'd talk just a little bit about the crime crisis, why I think a bipartisan or nonpartisan approach is most important, and what I think we need to see from the state of Washington. First, Mayor of Everett, Washington, it's a beautiful city. There's a lot of good going on. We've opened Payne Field. We've been welcoming next generation businesses, seeing our city open back up post-COVID with lots of events and activities. But we're also seeing an unprecedented rise in violent crime, in gun violence, and people dying on our streets every day from the fentanyl crisis. This is something I take really seriously, not just as mayor. Public safety needs to be our number one priority. It's my duty to keep our community safe. But I'm also the mom of a 14-year-old middle schooler, and I worry about her and her friends every day. When I send her to school, I never thought I'd have to tell my daughter not to take an Advil or a Midol or anything from a friend because it might be laced with fentanyl. So before I get into addressing those challenges, I want to talk a little bit about nonpartisanship or bipartisanship. Public safety is not a partisan issue. Just like potholes, parks, transportation, all the things we do in local government is actually everyone should care equally about. In Snohomish County, I feel really lucky. We have some really great collaborative leaders. I always talk about mayors don't see parties. We are the party of getting stuff done. So we don't really care whether you have an R or a D. And I know we might have some R's in here. I happen to be a D, so thank you for having me. But public safety is really an important issue, and it's critical that we bring all those voices to the table to solve the challenges we have, because we have huge challenges in this state. And if we're not listening to all the voices and all the potential solutions, we're not going to get it right. So like many communities, Everett has been dealing with the opioid crisis. In fact, we were the first city to sue the opioid manufacturer. And that's clapworthy. But in recent years, open public drug use has become much more prevalent. And what I get frustrated with is there's this sense of urgency that we all, then when we walk our streets and the mayors and local government, we have this sense of urgency because we're seeing people die on the streets. I was recently in D.C. and I was talking about this, and it's like, well, you're talking about a war on drugs. I'm like, no, I'm not talking about a war on drugs. I'm talking about people dying every day on our streets and actually impacting everyone around them. This is a very different crisis than anything we've seen in the past. We're seeing damage at storefronts, litter all over our communities, in our schoolyards, evidence of fentanyl use and drug paraphernalia. And we've limited law enforcement's ability to address this issue. We have to offer people help multiple times, but when you're asking someone if they want help and they're incredibly high, they're not going to accept services. And when folks talk about, well, they need to want to accept services to get treatment, well, for fentanyl, rock bottom is death. So that's not acceptable. And for me, it's not safe or compassionate to allow those people to live outside without the help and support that they need. It's not safe for them, and it's not safe for the rest of our community. So in Snohomish County, to address this, the mayors got together and said, we aren't seeing what we need to see at the state level, so we're going to work together across party lines. And we formed a Mayors for and Business Leaders for Public Safety Coalition. 16 mayors of Snohomish County, led by myself, Mayor Nearing of Marysville, Mayor Witta of Sultan, and Mayor Gailey of Lake Stevens, brought together all of our voices and said, look, we've got to address some of these major issues we're seeing. We want to address the police pursuits. We want to address the Blake decision. We want to see some action from the state to balance accountability and enforcement with treatment and compassion. And I think we can accomplish all of that. So that's what we set out to do. And part of that, I think, is understanding that our state does not have the solutions right now. We do not have the treatment centers we need, and it's going to take decades to get the treatment centers we need. So in the meantime, one of the best treatment centers we have is our jail system. And that sounds very harsh, but guess what? In jail, I can keep people alive. When we get somebody off the streets and into jail, they're getting medically assisted treatment, Suboxone, they're getting medical care, they're detoxing, and that may provide them just the lifeline they need by the time they're out a few days later to actually readily engage in treatment. And so we've tried to help our legislature, our state leaders understand that. We also tried to help them understand that our local jurisdictions need some flexibility. What works in Seattle might not be the same thing that works in Darrington. What works in Everett might not be the same thing that works in Bellevue. We, as local leaders, know our community, see the needs every day, and we want the support there to bring the systems in that work for our communities. The last thing I think that we wanted to really advocate for was support for law enforcement. It's sad that Washington State has become one of the most difficult places in the nation to be a police officer. Our police officers are overwhelmed. They're overworked. They're underpaid. And this is one of the most difficult places to recruit officers. We are losing officers to other states all across the country. And I think that we, as a community, need to prioritize how do we make the state of Washington the best place to be a police officer again? How do we show our officers that this is a place that they want to work and where people want to come to Washington State to be a police officer? So there was a lot of work in the legislature this year. We did finally see a Blake fix at the end of session, their special session. You know, I'll honestly say it's better than what existed before. It obviously makes possession in public use gross misdemeanors. It reviews the requirement to offer multiple treatment. Those are both positive things. A couple of concerns we have was the preemption of possession of drug paraphernalia, meaning we can't arrest somebody who has a bunch of drug paraphernalia. There's no mandatory jail minimums and no accountability to complete treatment. So that what that could create, again, is a revolving door. And it doesn't solve the officer presence rule, meaning our officers have to witness drug use and drug possession in order to arrest. So as mayors, we're going to do what we can and implement these rules that have come. And if they're not working, we're going to continue to advocate to the state for what we need to see. But I want to be clear, it's not just drug possession that is a challenge in this state. We need more treatment. Obviously, this is the way out of the drug crisis. We need to increase transparency into how we're spending our money on homelessness, behavioral health, and how we make those programs more effective. And we need transparency into our criminal justice system. We need to look at what our sentencing legislation is, and are we setting the right range, or are we allowing people immediately back out on the street? Again, that's the balance of accountability and compassion. Couple things that I'm very concerned about, and I know our mayor's group is going to continue to focus on, is how we prioritize the unlawful possession of firearm cases and other dangerous crimes as we're working through the systems that need to be improved in the state. And again, the support for our law enforcement officers, the changes that are necessary so that they can do their jobs. And honestly, all of the officers I know, they're doing this because they want to help people. They want to protect us, and they want to keep our communities safe. So I think he's telling me it's time. They're going to like start cutting me off. I just want you to know that your local cities are doing what they can. They are putting the systems in place, and you've got great mayors all across the state that are working together to address these challenges. So thank you for allowing me to be here and join you tonight. Yeah. Someone else is going to have to grab that.
I have Seattle PD legally chasing me over I don't know what.
Okay,
I was leaving my car and they're chasing me.
Okay, are you able to pull? Are you able to, sir? Are you able to pull over and talk with officers, find out what's going on?
No, it's an illegal pursuit and my license is suspended. And it's an illegal pursuit. The task will tend to be for. They're not supposed to be able to chase.
Starting today, the Seattle Police Department's patrol shifts are operating under new hours. The change coming in response to the low staffing issues the department's been dealing with for a few years now.
Crime is still really high. We're still down a lot of cops. We're down about 10% of our police force.
The Seattle Police Department is still losing more police officers than it can hire.
That means fewer people to respond to 911 calls in a city where violent crime is at a 15-year high.
Please welcome to the stage, Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz. Snohomish County Council Member Jared Mead. Pierce County Sheriff Ed Troyer. And your moderator and afternoon host, Jason Rance.
Hello. We have a little bit of a policing problem, don't we?
Well, keep your elected sheriff, and it'll go away a lot quicker.
Let's dive right in. So I'll start with Sheriff Troyer. How much of the crime crisis that we're currently experiencing is directly related to policy?
Most of it. All of it. Absolutely. All the reform, all the no chasing cars, let all the kids go. If you've read down in Pierce County last week, we've had three sets of shootings and robberies, all juvenile kids and stolen cars. Every one of them, I'll bet you when we catch them, have been in jail multiple times in the last year. It's kind of a catch and release thing, especially with juveniles. They say, well, kids 17 and under can't make the decision whether to commit crimes or not, right? Yeah, so that's really our problem right now is the lack of enforcement. I mean, I believe in rehab and counseling and everything else you can do. That's why we have a bunch of mental health counselors that ride with my deputies. But you got to have something on the back end for the really bad.
Chief Diaz, Do we go too easy on juvenile criminals or juvenile suspects?
You know, I think if there's a way that if you have a first offense or first couple offenses, you've got to be able to figure out how do you restore somebody back into the community, because you don't want to use it to be always a punishable system. However, you do have to have accountability. So whatever processes, sometimes that is jail. Sometimes, honestly, taking somebody to jail is going to save their life because they've been involved at a shooting scene multiple times, and they are going to be the next victim. So actually putting them in, incarcerating them, actually could potentially save their lives. And I think even some of the outreach workers actually understand that piece as well. So,
Councilmember, there seems to be a move to keep as many people out of jail regardless of how often they are accused of committing a crime. You're a Democrat. We don't hold that against you. But it does seem like, are we putting too much politics into policing?
I think politics has absolutely negatively impacted policing. As soon as politics gets involved in most things, it tends to negatively impact that thing. But specifically with community safety and policing, you see policies that tie some of our officers' hands behind their backs when they're trying to go out in the community and keep people safe. The original question was about keeping people out of jail. And, you know, I think it is a good policy to start trying to work towards finding ways to divert people so we're not filling up cells expensively to the community for people who maybe could use other resources to get off the street, get out of the cycle of recidivism. But at the same time, accountability has to come. It can't just be compassion. And I may vary a little to the right in my own party when I say stuff like that, but it shows in the data that you can't just go one way with it. And
we won't tell them that you said that.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things is being the sheriff is I get to run Pierce County Jail. And our jails are no longer jails. They're mini prisons. 85% of the people in our jails have mental health and drug or alcohol convictions, and 93% are felons. We have 26 people awaiting murder trials. We have 15 juveniles that have been reprimanded to adult status waiting murder trials. And then we also have about 70 people that the courts have ordered for their mental health restoration rights to be done, and they're not getting done because Western State doesn't have the room, the state's not taking care of it, and the judges have recently started fining the state to pay these people that are in jail. We have a couple inmates that have been in jail for a year and haven't had their mental health hearings yet, and they're getting $200 a day by sitting in jail paid by the state because the state can't get it done. So jails, like you said, we don't want people in jail that don't need to be there, absolutely, or kids, but we have hardcore felons in our jails. They're like mini prisons.
So Chief Diaz, I think everyone here agrees that politics getting involved in policing is not the best move. You're in a really difficult position, right? Unlike the sheriff, you're not elected. You report to the mayor. In a lot of ways, you report also directly to the council. So how do you balance, and how should we balance policing when it comes to oversight at that local level?
Well, we have a lot of oversight. We've been under consent decree, so we've had an inspector general and community police commission and OPA, and you've got all these layers of accountability in our system. So you're trying to make sure you're working in those environments. You also have policies that are also, you know, looking at best practices and trying to figure out how do you police better in the community. And these are all challenges, and then that doesn't include the elected component of it. These are just stuff that you're actually just trying to structurally do. But at the end of the day, like, it's trying to make sure that the officers have the equipment and tools, the ability to do what is needed for them to actually make the city as safe as it can be. And, you know, I know our officers are, they become resilient. They become very, very agile to be able to try and make sure that they're working within policy, they're working within the law, and that they're actually making really good arrests. Like this year, or this last year, we actually recovered the second most amount of guns than we've ever recovered. And so, like, that's really what you're trying to make sure that you get to, is good policing, and that they're actually making the city as safe as possible.
Who did you recover the guns from?
You know, most of our guns are coming from a variety of different ways. So sometimes it can be for domestic violence cases. It can be for extreme risk protection orders. But a lot of the cases are where people are shooting. We have about 40% of our guns are used in two cases or more, and so that we recover. And so guns that are coming out on the street, it's not just once and then it's done. It's actually being used multiple times. And that's where, when it gets passed along, That's where you're trying to figure out who's preying on the community, and we've got to put those people in the bar.
Councilmember, the state legislature decided this year and previous sessions to limit our constitutional right to bear arms. And certainly there are a lot of conservatives in this audience who certainly believe that our rights are being violated. Why should I not be able to have my Glock have a magazine that carries 15 rounds in the context of the crime crisis? I'm not the one committing crimes.
Well, so I wasn't in the legislature when they voted on that. We haven't considered that on the county council level. But if you're asking for my personal perspective on it, I also stray a little bit off from my party, center right, when it comes to the protection of the Second Amendment. So I don't know the specifics of the legislation you're referring to as far as ammo rounds in the clip, but I do think that in Washington State we've gone a little bit too far, and I think in future years risk going a little further if we don't make this clear that there's a priority in protection of the Second Amendment in Washington State.
Sheriff, what are your general views on these restrictions on guns? That's called a softball.
Well, first of all, being elected sheriff, if anybody tells me to come for your guns or magazines or extended magazines, it's not going to happen. They can send the state troopers to do that, but we're not going to do that. It's already kind of crazy because I'm not a big gun person, but I have four or five of my own personal guns.
And, on you right now.
Well, no. No. But when I walk into a gun store right now, armed, obviously armed, and they know I'm the sheriff, and I still buy a gun, I still have to wait 10 days as I walk out of the store armed. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's some things that need to kind of be reeled back a little bit because of the war on law enforcement. And what's happening is we're losing officers to other states because I hire one-third of my department's military. And as most people know, Inslee and Ferguson aren't my fans, mainly because started when we didn't do the mandate vaccination. So I've got 20 officers. Yeah. And I'm sorry, Chief, I've got four or five of your people. And they're great people. We've got four or five Seattle people and others that were going to get fired, and I hired them. Through Fish and Wildlife, State Patrol, and everything. Great people, but I'm not an anti-vaxxer, but I'm a freedom of choice. And so we hired them.
Well, let's talk about staffing, Chief. I mean, SPD is not doing well when it comes to staffing. You're not bringing in nearly enough. I think the estimate or the projection at the end of the year is that maybe you'll bring in five more than you lose, something around there. I'm told you guys need 500. So, number one, what do you view as the actual problem and what's being done about it?
It's really trying to figure out, like, what could we actually draw people into this work? And I've talked to chiefs across the country. Everybody's experiencing some level of staffing issue. I'm trying to make sure that we actually put good incentives on the table, things that are long-term that keeps people in the profession. I want to see stuff like medical retirement. I want to see stuff that actually gets people to say, like, this is a profession rather than a job that I can only be in there for 7 years and I'm going to leave it. Mm-hmm. And so you really are just, you know, that's a struggle. Right now, it's a very difficult job. A lot of, like, there's a lot of accountability in the officer. The officer is scrutinized for every aspect of what they do. So it's difficult to really do that recruiting. But actually, while our recruiting challenges are huge, last year, we lost probably like 80 officers more than we had. So to get to five officers over, like, that's a better transition, but we still have a long way to go.
Would you want to work, if you were not an officer and you were thinking about getting into law enforcement, would you want to work for this Seattle City Council?
You know, that's actually interesting because when I came on the job, I didn't know any members of the Seattle City Council. I didn't come into the job because of City Council. I came in because I actually want to serve. I want to actually go out and do work. And it's Seattle. We have a lot of shootings. We have a lot of crime. And if I want to actually go out and do that level of service, like, I need to be in a big city to be able to do that. And it's not anything against small cities. I just like to be more active. I like to be proactive. And so it does draw people to it. It should draw people to it. I know there's a lot of restrictions on policies and all that kind of stuff, but at the end of the day, like, officers are doing really, really good work, and I'm trying to highlight all the work that they do every single day. They put their life on the line, and you know, they're recovering guns and making good arrests and solving crimes, and that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, and in Snohomish County, I mean, there's been some staffing issues. I know I talked with Mill Creek PD about some of those issues, but for the most part, you've been able to avoid the overly left-wing defund groups. How does that happen?
Well, I joined County Council in 2020. I was in the legislature before that, and that was I joined in April of 2020. George Floyd was killed in May of 2020. That's when the defund the police and all of that craziness started. I was appointed chair of the Law and Justice Human Services Committee my first month there. So all of those policies kind of came right through my committee. And the way that we were able to hold that back was to, I mean, we did joint proclamations, resolutions between myself, a Democrat, and another Republican on council, thanking our officers for the work that they're doing, recognizing that, and this was in the heat. This was in July of 2020 when all the riots were happening and Molotov cocktails were getting thrown in Seattle at precincts. And we did a resolution that said, hey, we love that what you're doing in our communities. We know that it's hard right now to be a police officer. Stay in Snohomish County. We've increased benefits to our officers. We've increased wellness, health benefits to our officers. And so I think a lot of it, some of it is policy, but I think a lot of it is also the culture and what we're putting out to the communities and how our officers feel they're respected or seen by community members.
And that last point, it's the community, right? I mean, I understand why officers in Seattle are frustrated. I hear from them. I don't hear that from King County deputies as much. I don't hear them at all from Pierce County or Snohomish County or Thurston County, for that matter. How should they deal with, in Seattle, a community that is actively fighting against cops?
Is that the question? For me, as elected officials, we have a responsibility to set the tone in our communities. And in Seattle, unfortunately, they have elected officials who are setting a negative tone when it comes to policing. And so, of course, you're going to have community members echoing what certain Seattle City Council members will be screaming. And we have a system right now that's set up to incentivize really dumb people to say, or people to say really dumb things really loudly.
I think you were right the first time.
I didn't say dumb people. You said dumb people. But we have a system that incentivizes that, dumb things to get said loudly and oversimplification of issues like policing, like law enforcement. And so, of course, if you have elected leaders, like in Seattle City Council, saying overly simplified messages that are really extreme, and then they dig in rigidly on their ideologies, of course, that's going to trickle down to the community members who are saying, well, the person I elected and that I respect that's leading me is saying this. I'm going to parrot that. And that's how that toxic environment spreads throughout a community, and then you get officers that feel disrespected.
Well, let's talk about one of those, to quote you, dumb policies. Vehicular pursuit bill, a ban, a little bit different policy on this stage, regardless of that bill. But there was, I guess they're calling it a compromise that really didn't address the issue there. How much of the crime do you think is directly related to the fact that you can't chase? That's for the sheriff.
Well, it's not a matter of can't chase, because we don't chase people around in circles for a long time like they make it sound like. Once we know they're going to run, we have very good tools to take them out really quick. So we can't do that, and they know that. One Saturday night, we had one of our sergeants count how many people ran from us on regular traffic stops. We had 38 people that didn't stop. And I was talking to my people, and they're like, yeah, sometimes they actually stick their middle finger at us, and we kind of appreciate that, because then we know they're not going to stop. We don't even have to start. I'm like, who the heck would ever thought we would have gotten there, you know? But we have some really cool new tools coming. I'm sending a team to Phoenix to train on some things, and I wish I could tell you about some of the things we're going to be doing, but by the end of the summer, you'll follow them, and I'll get with you. But we don't want to give away our secrets, because we really believe that, you know, the majority of the problem is being created by a small percentage on these car thief people. It is. And if we can take those small percentage out and the top 100 criminals out, you'll see a stop in crime.
Yeah, and that's the same in pretty much every city that's dealing
with
this.
And you know where in Pierce County, you know where the most cars are stolen from? Hmm. Within six blocks of the jail, because they need a ride home. True. The circle's really dark.
It's time management.
That's what got them there, and that's what got them home.
You know? So, Chief, SPD before the law had a policy that basically outlawed not outlawed, but the policy was against chases. And I understand why you might not want to get in a chase in downtown Seattle at 5 o'clock on a Tuesday. What's the problem with any kind of pursuit based upon the officer's judgment at 11 p.m. on that Tuesday?
So our focus actually is we have the probable cause standard for violent crimes, and we focus on violent crimes when it comes to the pursuits. The reason why is typically our biggest payouts of car accidents that we actually that end up ending death, it's a massive amount. It's a massive amount when it comes to pursuits. And so, like, when you have to go to a family and say, like, you lost your loved one because we were in a pursuit for a small level of crime, that's a huge issue for us. And we still are pursuing. I can tell you that I regularly, especially in the summer of last year, I felt like there was a pursuit every single day. Because there's crime every single day. There's violent crime every single day. And so officers are doing everything they can to, you know, help solve, you know, stop some of the pursuits. We're taking some of the, you know, other tools that, you know, Sheriff Troyer probably is also trying to implement as well, because we also want to figure out how do we stop these situations so it doesn't escalate into a potential death. And so I think everything in policing is, like, how do we create it so we're not in this long pursuit at high speeds that literally could have jeopardize the community. And so that's that balance.
But how much do you think the general culture of lawlessness that has very clearly surged over the last several years impacted that? Because you've got folks who are saying, yeah, I don't have to stop.
Well, I think it comes down exactly to what we've also been talking about. You have sometimes the same utilizers that literally are stealing multiple cars over and over and over again. Not just like 8 times, 15 times, 20 times. And that's where you got to figure out, how do we do really good police work, getting good cases in there, and making sure our prosecutors are doing their work and making sure that they're charged and people are being held. Because at the end of the day, it's accountability. You got to have it. I've got to be able to have people to be able to prosecute. I've got to make sure that the jails are going to hold people, because all it is going to do is I'm going to have high levels of auto theft. And then anything when it comes to other crimes, violent crimes, like, you've got to be able to make sure that people do not allow it to understand that all they're going to do is just run. You've got to have that. Like, people have to know that we can pursue. And right now, like during the state law, we had to have certifications and in some sort of police intervention. So I had to write. It was like one of the hardest things you do. But I had to write a directive basically saying, for right now, we cannot pursue.
I posted that memo on Twitter 10 minutes after you sent it.
Yeah. And that's not it. Let me tell you, it wasn't the easiest thing. I had to get my team. I said, I need this done in a week and a half. Like, we need to be able to get back up into pursuits. And so we had literally just tried to rush to make sure that we put all the things in place, because I can't have a homicide suspect, but I got to make sure that I protect the officers. But I can't have a homicide suspect go out, commit a crime, and then we're not going to pursue them. It just can't happen that way. And so that's the reason why it's like, no, team, let's get it. Let's get to the table. Let's get this done. And we did it.
So we have 1 minute left. Same question for all of you, about 15 seconds each. What if you can make one change to a policy, whether it's a law or just a policy on the books, that would make policing safer for your officers but result in a safer community? What would you do? We'll start with the sheriff.
Well, just last 2 weeks ago, I was in D.C. and put two of my guys on the wall that were killed in the line of duty. Last year, I did one. I've had six since I've been around of our 10. And a lot of it comes down to, when we look at the people that shot and killed our people, they've all were three strikes candidates. They've all been in prison multiple times. They've been through the rotating door, and they knew they were going to go away again and wanted to fight it out. We should not have to be put in that position. But we got to make sure that those people are held accountable so they don't hurt other people. So right now, the state has 3,005.
You're listening to a special edition of the Jason Rantz Show, as we bring to you this past Wednesday's Freedom Series, recorded live in Renton at the Carco Theater.
And Brian, thank you for organizing this event and being here. It's been very wonderful to have you and listen to you, as I do every day and every morning. So my question for you is, you know, I hear from a lot of local Republican elected officials and whatnot, that if you see an issue in your area, your neighborhood, you know, run for an office and do that. And so I was upset about the school district that is in my area, and so I ran for school board. But, you know, when we talk about crime...
Did you win?
No.
Didn't I interview you?
You did. Yeah. Yeah. 2021. Yeah. So, you know, as we look at something like crime, you know, you could run for sheriff, unless you're in King County, but what can you really do about crime? Because you can't really run for sheriff unless you're a police officer.
And policy has been behind so much of the crime. And so if you're able to get in a position of power, you can change policy. And that doesn't always mean that you run for something. You're going to be able to make an impact.
Shoot criminals. Yeah, there's no Narcan for a 300 blackout. So, oh, sorry.
Thank you. Two more questions.
Good evening. I have a comment and a question. My comment is, I think during the Obama administration, people greatly underestimated kind of his organizing, community organizing, and just all the seeds he planted that I think we're seeing come to fruition in a lot of ways, in the way that the left has been able to coordinate really effectively from a ground up. And one of the things that happened in 2020 and 2021 is I suddenly started watching King County Council meetings and the King County Housing Authority and Health Board meetings. And you can tell by the attendance level that people are not engaged or interested. And the little thing that happened with Mark Downs, I think it was, or the King County Housing Downs. Authority and the Zoom. These little gems happen all the time that are happening. And I would be on some of these meetings seeing this like, okay, I'm like, one of maybe five people paying attention. And it was sort of like, where is everyone and why aren't they paying attention? And if there was a way to, this is my question, I guess, if there was a way for to network where people are paying attention or watching and then informing about when these things happen. I know it's starting to come out with social media and stuff like that, but this has been happening for years, and they're really things that are detrimental to us knowing and understanding. So if there's a way to network, that'd be awesome.
First of all, I'm glad I'm not the only one who suffers through those videos, so thank you for joining me. The truth is, there's plenty of networking going on at both the state and county levels. You connect with your local Republican county group, and they can help you with all of this. They have email lists that go out. They tell you when things are happening. There are also community organizations, various ones depending on where you're living, that do exactly the same thing. But the other truth is, you're going to have to do some research yourself. I mean, they post everything online, agendas. And when you see something that's important, that's being discussed, how many people are you telling about, telling that this is happening? How many people are you sending the link to? But everyone has to do that.
Yeah.
Everyone has to do that because it's difficult to show up to a meeting at, you know, 11 a.m. on a Tuesday. You're working, right? So.
And they count on that.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, you know, I don't want you all to turn into 14-year-old girls, but if you don't have Instagram, you know, whatever, but if you do... there's a couple different feeds that highlight the excesses of the homeless, mm-hmm. and one of them is Seattle Looks Like SHXT, right? It's terrific, and they will repost one from Portland called WTF, whatever that stands, Portland, WTF Portland, right? And it's crazy, because if you know how to grab those and then put them on your Facebook page so your grandkids or whoever can see them, they're not political, they're shocking, and you say, that's where I live. That's Tacoma, that's Olympia, Olympia is the biggest city close to me. You never see what's going on there. The biggest homeless camp is between Lacey and Olympia on both sides of I-5. And they're stabbing and killing and each other left and right. But get involved in social media. Let other people
and
populate
post.
That stuff. Repost it.
But also do it yourself if you're able to safely get video and photos.
Yeah.
That's what moves the needle for a lot of people.
And half of it is like the red light in Portland sticking their camera out.
Yeah.
But that shocks people into action. And then they do it too. And I'm Brian Does Junk on Instagram, by the way.
I do junk.
My name is Ken Blevins. I'm from Federal Way. I started Stand Up Federal Way a couple years ago during the pandemic.
I think I interviewed you, too.
Yes, you did. And just ended up seeing a homeless drug addiction problem in front of me. I didn't know what the heck it was until I ran into it and talked to people and realized they're addicts, not homeless. Just figured out we'd try to get rid of the homeless out of Federal Way. It doesn't work out like that. Found out that King County is working against us. Seattle's sending them down here. The state's making laws that are regionalizing homelessness. And we ended up getting political. We showed up to the council meetings. We basically replaced all the loud people that were for all this harm reduction and all this other crap that we're getting. And we were the loud people. We changed things a lot. We went out and there, we voted in a new council, which changed the whole landscape there. But we realized that they were still working against us at the state level, and we got our butts kicked this last time. We won our council, but we got our butts kicked. So hopefully we'll be able to do some kind of ballot harvesting and actually get our state back, because that's how we're winning.
You should. Yeah. We have to embrace it's perfectly legal, and silly that we're not doing it and letting Democrats do it.
Yeah, we don't know how to do it. We didn't know what it was, but we put out over 30,000 mailers at the door to talk to people, and most people agreed with us, but we just didn't get the votes. So that's what it was. We worked real hard. You just can't give up. Show up to your council, people. My question is different from this, is why can't we get these mayors to basically, or the county or someone, all these hotels that they've bought already, they're housing people and they're not focusing on addiction. Why can't they just take that first level and remodel it? She said, oh, it's going to take decades to put all these hospitals out there. It's not. We already have the housing. We got them in there. Let's just start arresting people. Take the people out of there, let them break the law to get on their drugs, arrest them, put them back in there with a doctor, or mental health, and all that stuff. They can stay there for a year, year and a half, get well, get them jobs and so on, and end this thing in the next 10 years, not wait 10 years to do something. So what's stopping us from doing that?
What's stopping us are the people who are in charge and making these decisions. They are hardcore advocates of harm reduction, which means they're not pushing treatment. We played audio on both of our shows today, actually, of a Seattle activist who flat out said, we're for bodily autonomy for the drug user. We don't want to stigmatize them, which is essentially what their position is.
Who are we to judge? And if you don't know, if this has never been in your life, what's going on right now with the Chinese fentanyl is... because I had this discussion with a colleague on a different station, and I was telling him they love the fentanyl, they love the heroin more than their own kid. And he said, well, I had an aunt who was an addict, and she never stopped loving us. And I said, you know why? Because you weren't between her and her heroin. That's why. And you have to understand, they won't go in that hotel with the counseling and the, you know, soft hot rock massage and all that you want. They would rather stay there in their filth, in the tent, getting high in between stealing mountain bikes. And I've tangentially talked about this on the air, but I'll tell you guys, what blew up my marriage, and I was married to a very high-functioning, brilliant person, an Issaquah cop. She became addicted to heroin because she had chronic pain. She didn't tell me. She lied for years and years and years. And then one day, there was fentanyl in the heroin, and then one day she loved that shot more than her beautiful, brilliant 10-year-old daughter. So I had to make a choice to either be the chairman of the committee to save a marriage or be the chairman of the committee to save a 10-year-old girl and raise her into a functioning human, and I chose the latter, and that's why I'm back here. Now, it really is the only choice. And you know, we wish her well, but we haven't heard. We don't even know if she's alive. It was 2 years ago. But seeing the power of that, it blew me away. I couldn't believe I didn't see it for so long, because addicts just lie. That's all they do. And that was 20 years ago when it was just heroin. With this stuff here, they will let it, you know. Well, if you tell them, well, okay, watch out, this new stuff has trank, and it'll kill your body from the inside out. They're like, yeah, but I can get high, right? Okay. And they have lost all agency. And that's why the most compassionate thing is a psych hold, is a sentence to put them in Western State and staff Western State. And the numbers say only 10% of them rehab. Okay. The other 90%, you know, I don't know what to say.
Thank you so much for coming out. We're always just in awe of the audience that comes to see us, and we're grateful for the ones who stay. It is getting late, and we're grateful for all your listenership. We're going to meet you guys out in the lobby for some photos if you would like, and we look forward to seeing you at the next Freedom Series. Thanks, guys.